parables are basically coded stories about the soul and its function. In other words, they take an abstraction, like the unmoving starts to move, or the immortal pretends to be born, and express it in language that is much more understandable. Some parables are so simple that we hardly realize their spiritual meaning. Every child has heard about the 6 blind men and the elephant. Each blind man grabs a different part of the beast. The blind man who grabs the leg says, "An elephant is very like a tree." The one who grabs the trunk says, "An elephant is very like a snake." The one who grabs the tail says, "An elephant is very like a rope," and so forth. Originally, the story had to do with the 5 senses and the mind being unable to grasp the nature of God. The moral being, that divine reality, was too vast to be understood by thought, sight, sound, touch, or taste. Other interpretations hold that the blind men are the branches of Vedic philosophy, which in all their specialized learning cannot grasp the wholeness of Brahman, the one and all. Jesus told 39 parables and delivered the morals himself. The first one is in the 5th book of Matthew. "You are light for all the world. A town that stands on a hill cannot be hidden. When a lamp is lit, it isn't put under a bushel basket, but on the stand where it gives light to everyone in the house. And you, like the lamp, must shed light among all men, so that when they see the good you do, they may give praise to your Father in heaven." On the surface, this parable is so simple that it hardly needs to be interpreted. The phrase, "don't hide your light under a bushel basket," means that virtue should be seen so it can have a good effect. But the word light has a deeper meaning spiritually, in the sense of awakened awareness, and therefore this is also a parable about the soul. Jesus is saying that like a lamp hidden under a basket, the body hides the soul. He tells the disciples not to let this happen, but to allow the soul's awareness to manifest itself. In other words, live from the soul level if you expect other people to believe that you are connected to God. For when they see that you are, they will believe it of themselves as well. Any of the other famous parables, whether about the mustard seed, or the prodigal son, or the servant who buries his talents, are equally multidimensional. The actors in them can be seen as aspects of the soul. In fact, these vignettes are so effective and colorful that the soul gets overlooked. The same happens in real life. It is very hard to realize that our origin, our source, is not of this world. Here I am with all my qualities. People see me and hear me, they believe in my existence. Yet my reality is paper thin at the quantum level, where there is no sound, sight, texture, color, or anything else recognizable. The soul is the junction point between my virtual self and my physical self. It is the organizing intelligence that keeps me intact. This is an exceptional feat, given that every atom of my body is pure empty space with flashes of energy passing through it for no more than a few millionths of a second. Reality is truly sneaking up on us from nowhere and catching us off guard at every second. In a beautiful aphorism, the great Bengali poet Tagore says, "Life is only the perpetual surprise that I exist." It is unsettling to confront the fact that none of my cherished qualities are real. Yet, it is a fact. Let us say that I like the color blue, feel happy and value my personal freedom. These are 3 disparate qualities about me. But when I get in my car and drive across town, does the color blue move with me? When I take a bath, does my happiness get wet? When I go to bed, does my personal freedom go to sleep? It was just this sort of questioning that made the ancient sages realize that we must possess a soul. There is something intangible and undefined about us that gets born into this world as a visible, defined creation. In the Bhagavad Gita, this aspect is called the inward dweller, and it is said that fire cannot burn it, water cannot make it wet, wind cannot blow it away, and a sword cannot cut it in two. For all the poetry in that expression, the fact of the soul appears to be undeniable, for stripped of all religious connotations, the essence of each person cannot be reduced to matter or thoughts or any fixed quality. If you try to do without the soul, you wind up with a handful of nothing. To underscore this, I need to bring back the concept of the field. A magnet attracts iron because it creates a magnetic field around itself. As we saw before, the field doesn't move, yet the iron does. If you tried to locate the exact point where the unmoving field touches the moving iron, where would you be? The answer is that you would be at the point of uncertainty. A very definite object, a piece of iron, is interacting with a completely undefined thing, a field. The two get closer and closer. The iron starts out as a solid lump of matter with weight and motion. The field starts out with no solidity or motion or any other material qualities. They approach, and of course neither one wants to give up its nature. The field wants to remain boundless, timeless and undefined. The iron wants to remain exactly the opposite. Inevitably, they meet as strangers, barely shaking hands, suspicious of each other. This is the region of uncertainty, where the defined world meets the undefined world. It connects two very different worlds without living in either. At this point of uncertainty, a photon may shoot out of a star to travel across the universe, yet nothing really travels. Only a certain charge flickers into existence, passes its energy to another charge, and disappears again. It is as real as anything gets, or to put it another way, as unreal as anything gets. There is a Zen story about two disciples who are looking at a flag fluttering in the breeze. "See that?" one says. "No one can doubt that the flag is moving." The other disagrees. "No, it is the wind moving. The flag has no motion of its own." They continue this debate until the master comes along and he says, "You are both wrong. Only consciousness is moving." This is the kind of tale that gets often repeated as the answer to a Zen riddle, but which no one really understands. Now we are in a position to see the point. The flag stands for any material object that seems to move. The wind is the invisible force or field that creates the motion. But in the deeper reality, neither is moving, only consciousness, which means intelligence, is at work, here and in all things. It is profound to realize that my true self is not rooted in time and space. Virtual reality is my source, and like a light wave, my body flows out of it, but the source doesn't go anywhere. Therefore, my connection to that source doesn't go anywhere either. Thus, the soul is part of me, but not any part my senses will ever detect. No religious claim is being made here. These are stubborn quantum facts. I have never left my source. It is always with me. The famous detachment of great sages comes from knowing full well that they are not confined by any fixed definition. Tagore has a beautiful way of expressing this. "When I was born and saw the light, I was no stranger in this world. Something inscrutable, shapeless, and without words appeared in the form of my mother. So when I die, the same unknown will appear again as ever known to me." The metaphor of birth is totally appropriate because the timeless doesn't just turn into time. Something entirely new is born. Infinity doesn't merely shrink until it becomes small and manageable. Numberless dimensions give birth to just three or four. What you call your soul manages this birth, not once, but thousands of times per second. I call this concept Genesis Now. There can never be a single Genesis, since virtual reality would just swallow everything back up again. Supergravity, like an immense yawning black hole, has an insatiable appetite. It wants to devour time and make it timeless. It wants to engulf matter and energy to return them to virtual photons. Why isn't the whole world swallowed up? Because creation insists on happening. Life can't be stopped, even by the infinite forces arrayed against it. Genesis Now is the ongoing project that is behind all your actions. Soul work never stops. Attempting to put yourself in a box, defining yourself by labels and qualities until you are a finished product once and for all, is as false as trying to put God in a box. The great spiritual traditions have been trying to tell us this with all their teachings. We would otherwise forget that the constant churning of eternity, infinity, and immortality is all that is happening. There is nothing else. That alone makes us real. Believe it or not, we find ourselves very close to the soul now. We have whittled away the scientific objections to God by placing Him outside the reach of measurement. This means that a person's subjective experience of God can't be challenged. At the quantum level, objectivity and subjectivity merge into each other. The point of merger is the soul. Therefore, knowing God comes down to this. Like a photon nearing a black hole, your mind hits a wall as it tries to think about the soul. The soul is comfortable with uncertainty. It accepts that you can be in two places at once, time and eternity. It observes cosmic intelligence at work and is not bothered that the creative force is outside the universe. We have a simple picture of the situation then. The mind is creeping closer and closer to the soul, which sits on the edge of God's world at the event horizon. The gap of separation is wide when there is no perception of spirit. It grows smaller as the mind figures out what is happening. Eventually, the two will get so close that mind and soul have no choice but to merge. When that happens, the resemblance to a black hole is striking. To the mind, it will be as if falling into God's world lasts forever, an eternity in bliss consciousness. From God's side, the merging takes place in a split second. Indeed, if we stand completely in God's world, where time has no meaning, the whole process never even occurred. The mind was part of the soul all along, only without knowing it. One could rightfully claim that the words of Jesus, "Ask and you shall receive, knock and the door will open," are an iron law. The instant that your mind pays any attention to the soul, it is pulled toward it, with the inevitable result that all separation will close. Subjectively, this journey toward the soul, a better phrase than journey of the soul, is perceived as the seven stages that we have already covered. But objectively, the process is much more like a particle of light crossing the event horizon. The fact that our minds can register this journey is astonishing, because the whole time that it is happening, ordinary thought and perception continue. Two shoppers pushing grocery carts are doing the same thing in the material world, but one could be having an epiphany. The word ecstasy derives from Greek roots that mean to stand apart or outside. This is the role of second attention, to stand outside material life and witness the dawn of ecstasy. If you regard the soul as a kind of force field steadily pulling the mind toward it, every one of the seven stages can be described as the closing of separation. Stage 1. I am in such separation that I sense deep fear inside. Stage 2. I don't feel so separate. I'm gaining a sense of power. Stage 3. Something larger than me is drawing near. I feel much more peaceful. Stage 4. I am beginning to intuit what that larger thing is. It must be God. Stage 5. My actions and thoughts are drawing on God's force field as if we are both involved in everything. Stage 6. God and I are almost together now. I feel no separation. My mind is God's mind. Stage 7. I see no difference between myself and God. In ancient India, this closing of the gap was described as yoga or union. The same Sanskrit root gave us the verb to yoke. Because the sages had thousands of years to analyze it, the entire process of joining with the soul was turned into a science. Yoga precedes Hinduism, which is a particular religion, and at its inception, the practices of yoga were intended to be universal. The ancient sages had at their disposal the power to witness their own spiritual evolution, which boiled down to watching the mind approach the soul. What they discovered can be stated in a few cardinal points. Evolution takes place inside. It isn't a matter of pilgrimages, observances, and obeying religious rules. No codes of conduct can alter the fact that every mind is on a soul journey. Evolution is automatic. In the larger view, the soul is always pulling at us. Its force field is inescapable. A person is required to pay attention. Since the journey to the soul happens only in awareness, if you block out awareness, you impede your progress. If you pay attention, you build up momentum. The final goal is inevitable. No one can resist the soul forever. Saints and sinners are on the same road. It is better to cooperate than to resist. The soul is the source of truth and love. If you try to avoid it, those things will not increase in your life. If you cooperate, your life will be organized with the help of infinite power and intelligence as it flows from God. External action still counts. Action is a physical process linked to the mind. The two cannot be separated. So even though this is a journey of the mind, outer activity either helps or detracts. None of these statements is startling or particularly Indian. The fact that yoga was later identified with extremely esoteric practices is secondary. Because it started out as a neutral way of describing the reality of spiritual awakening, yoga is no less and no more objective than our quantum model. In both cases, one is concerned with how ordinary reality alters the closer one gets to the event horizon. This might be a good place to mention, for those who do not already know, that the physical exercises gathered under the name of Hatha Yoga constitute the smallest part of a huge body of understanding. They are not necessary on the spiritual journey, yet they are highly useful to those who feel attracted in that direction. If you accept that yoga is accurate in its description, then any aspect of life can be filtered through it. Let me take the issue of identity and view it in terms of initial separation that gradually becomes a state of union. Stage 1. I am small and insignificant, stranded on the vast expanse of nature. I hope I can survive. Stage 2. I can do more than survive. I can compete and fulfill more of my needs. Stage 3. I am peaceful inside. My inner world is beginning to satisfy me more than outward things. Stage 4. I am self-sufficient. Things may not always go my way, but that doesn't shake me anymore. Stage 5. I have discovered how to manifest my desires from within. My inner world turned out to have power. Stage 6. I am at the center of an immense scheme of power and intelligence that emanates from God. Stage 7. I am. You can accurately graph a person's spiritual growth on this scale alone. The ego moves from an isolated, helpless state to a realization that it might have power. Then it looks for where that power comes from, at first deciding that it must be external in the form of money and status, but in time realizing that the source of power is internal. More time passes and the difference between inner and outer power dissolves. All of reality is perceived as having one source. In the end, you are that source. Let's try another issue, that of faith. Stage 1, faith is a matter of survival. If I don't pray to God, He can destroy me. Stage 2, I am beginning to have faith in myself. I pray to God to help me get what I want. Stage 3, faith brings me peace. I pray that life should be free from turmoil and distress. Stage 4. I have faith that inner knowledge will uphold me. I pray for more insight into God's ways. Stage 5. Faith tells me that God will support my every desire. I pray that I am worthy of his faith in me. Stage 6. Faith can move mountains. I pray to be God's instrument of transformation. Stage 7. Faith melts into universal being. When I pray, I find that I am praying to myself. Notice how strikingly different the same word is in each stage. When people say that they have faith or that they believe in prayer, you cannot be certain what they mean without more understanding. This accounts for why there is such wild divergence of opinion about whether God listens to prayers and answers them. In relative terms, it all depends on your level of consciousness. At lower levels, the thoughts behind a prayer may be too diffuse to create a result. As separation closes, the gap between prayer and result is closed. Every prayer is answered. At the level of miracles, prayer has the power to alter outward events. Finally, in the state of unity consciousness, there is no need for prayer. Your every thought comes from the soul. Therefore, you would only be praying to yourself. A boundary is the same as a horizon. If you attempt to walk around the world, the horizon is the furthest boundary of your sight, yet it keeps advancing ahead of you as you move. The spiritual equivalent is stated eloquently in a verse from the mystical Catholic monk, Thomas Merton. The Lord travels in all directions at once. The Lord arrives from all directions at once. Wherever we are, we find that He has just departed. Wherever we go, we find that He has just arrived before us. In literal terms, this verse states two things. One, we already know. God is elusive because He exists in the domain of uncertainty, where time and space aren't fixed. The other is that God is always perceived within boundaries. We get only a limited idea of Him, and that limited idea keeps shifting. There is no cure for this misperception until the final stage of unity. Until then, the gap of separation keeps causing the mind to think it knows God when only partial knowledge is available. In shorthand form, here are the horizons that limit our vision in the seven stages. Stage 1, horizon of fear. I provide for the necessities and look out for myself. But when I get anxious, I feel lost. Only God knows why bad things happen in this world. Bounded by anxiety, insecurity, dependency. Stage 2, horizon of control. I exert power and relish competition as a way of fulfilling my ambitions. But when things get beyond my control, I am totally frustrated. Only God knows why things don't work out the way I plan. Bounded by guilt, duty, victimization. Stage 3, horizon of fatalism. I'm at peace with myself and know what is happening with me inside. But I lose my center when nothing makes sense anymore. Only God knows why destiny can be so cruel and capricious. Bounded by karma, introversion, lack of power. Stage 4, horizon of self-deception. I navigate through the world with much more intuition and insight than most people. But I can be misled by my inner voice at times. Only God knows why my intuition deceives me just when I need it most. Bounded by hidden secrets, past conditioning, ego needs. Stage 5, horizon of fantasy. My inner world is rich with new discoveries, and I have enough awareness to see that my thoughts come true. But some of my deepest wishes stay on the level of unreachable fantasies. Only God knows why this happens. Bounded by self-absorption, grandiosity, playing God. Stage 6, horizon of identity. My whole life is devoted to service, and I can be selfless in the face of great demands from others. But sometimes the suffering of humanity makes me want to escape this world. Only God knows why I can't lose myself in Him all the time. Bounded by thought, personal ego, traces of old conditioning. Stage 7. Infinity. No horizon. I see no difference between my mind and the mind in all things. My identity is one with all people. Only God knows that I am merged into Him in all dimensions at all times. Boundless. Perhaps this is the most telling chart of all, because we identify so completely with our boundaries. The horizon is fluid, however. Each stage breaks the boundaries of the one that came before. To someone in stage 2, where guilt serves to keep the ego from going mad with power, the absence of guilt doesn't seem possible. It would be a sure sign that stage 3 is looming should the person successfully find real forgiveness. Forgiveness is a mark of stage 3, and those who arrive there have pushed their projection of God just a little further. Society tends to cluster, like seeking like. At a party of psychiatrists, everyone believes in insight. At a party of entrepreneurs, everybody believes in success. This makes it hard to accept that God's values are any different. We all know marriages where both spouses are sure that the world is a certain way, whether it be dangerous, unsafe, abundant, benign, or blessed. Is this a form of organized deception? Yes and no. Although your boundaries define you, that shouldn't be taken as negative. Every stage of inner growth allows you the opportunity to see things that are hard to see. Projection is inevitable and very powerful. The boundaries of belief are true event horizons because the mind can't go beyond them, even though to an outsider, the boundaries don't exist. A fundamentalist Christian may be unable to conceive of divorce without believing that he will be thrown outside God's grace, just as an Orthodox Jew would find it inconceivable to break kosher laws or a Muslim to allow his wife to walk outside with her face uncovered. A stage 1 interpretation of Christ, if it reflects fear, would center on the times he warns of sinners cast into the outer darkness with wailing and gnashing of teeth. A stage 1 interpretation of Allah centers on the Quran's promise that one sin against God's laws is enough to deserve eternal damnation. These beliefs defy reason, and that is their purpose. Religions have always feared the end of faith. Recently, some Protestant sects attempted to remove all references in the liturgy to original sin and human imperfection, but they failed, even among liberal theologians. The winning argument was that only God is perfect, and we should never forget it. Obedience holds the religious world together and makes redemption possible. For God to have His place, human beings must know theirs. In every stage, the essential point is the same. You believe that God is holding you back for some reason. As long as you are in that stage, you will wrestle with what the reason is. This forms the core of your personal drama. In truth, you are projecting all boundaries. This becomes obvious when you see that other people have boundaries totally different from yours. The end of separation is preordained. Eventually, there is no more need for boundaries. The event horizon gets pushed as far as the mind will go, and after that, God must take over. The word mystical is used carelessly to describe many different things, but I would say that in any stage of inner growth, whatever lies outside your boundaries is mystical to you. The famous cargo cult among the Trobriand Islanders in the Pacific derived their religion when Allied planes dropped supplies from the sky during World War II. Being unable to comprehend what an airplane is, the islanders built straw effigies of them and prayed for their return. What was ordinary technology to us was across the event horizon for them. Even when you find yourself stagnated in fixed beliefs, the possibility of closing the gap is always present. Every morning, you have a new opportunity to know God. Your starting point may be one of fear and guilt, or it may be one of expanded awareness. That is all relative. According to our three ways of finding God, no one is ever trapped without hope. we can always cross the horizon to a new reality. Clues are left to tell us how to grow. Second attention enables us to read these clues. The saint is equal to the sinner in this regard. Both are guided by God from across the gap. The aim of spirituality is to learn to cooperate with God. Most of us have been raised to do the opposite. Our skills and abilities come from first attention and not second. As a result, our issues tend to center on the lower stages, where fear and neediness, however much we deny them, take their toll. In these early stages, the ego asserts its needs with great force. Money, security, sex, and power make huge claims on everyone in society. It is important to realize that God doesn't judge against these things. When people feel that they owe their success to God, they are right. When wrongdoing goes unpunished and good deeds are ignored, God smiles on both. There is only one reality, which is spiritual, and nothing lies outside God's mind. We tap into the source of creativity and intelligence with every thought. What makes a life spiritual, then? The difference is entirely one of intention. I began this audiobook by saying that people could be followed around from birth to death with a camera, and there would be no external way to show which one believed in God. This fact remains true. Unless you become a recluse or enter a monastery, your social role is irrelevant to how spiritual you are. Everything depends on intention. If someone uses kind words but intends to snub you, the intention cuts through. The most expensive gift cannot make up for lack of love. We know instinctively when intentions come from an honest place or a place of deception. In spiritual life, intention includes will and purpose, aspiration and highest vision. If you set your intention toward God, spirit grows. If you set your intention toward material existence, that will grow instead. Once you plant the seed of an intention, your soul's journey unfolds automatically. Here are the basic intentions that mark a spiritual life, stated in terms of what a person wants to achieve. I want to feel God's presence. This intention is rooted in the discomfort of being isolated and separate. When God is absent, the underlying feeling of loneliness cannot be escaped. You can mask it by developing friendships and family ties. Ultimately, however, each one of us needs to feel a sense of inner fullness and peace. We want to be satisfied within ourselves, no matter if we are alone or in a crowd. I want God to aid and support me. God's presence brings with it the qualities of spirit. At the source, every quality, love, intelligence, truth, organizing ability, creativity, becomes infinite. The growth of these things in your life is a sign that you're approaching closer to your soul. I want to feel connected to the whole. The soul's journey takes a person from a fragmented state to a state of wholeness. This is felt as being more connected. Events around you start to weave into a pattern. Small details fit together instead of being scattered and random. I want my life to have meaning. Existence feels empty in separation, and this gets healed only by moving into unity with God. Instead of turning outward to find your purpose, you feel that just being here as you are fulfills the highest purpose in creation. I want to be free of restrictions. Inner freedom is greatly compromised when fear is present, and fear is a natural outcome of separation. As you move closer to your soul, the old boundaries and defenses start to melt away. Instead of being wary about the future, you flow with the river of life, awaiting the day when no boundaries of any kind hold you back. If these basic intentions are present inside you, God takes the responsibility for carrying them out. Everything else you do is secondary. Someone who is in the grip of fear, for example, cannot move beyond stage one, despite good deeds, a secure home life, and positive thinking. We all attempt to mask our limitations with false attitudes. It is only human nature to try to appear better than we are, especially in our own eyes. But once you set your intention in the right direction, self-deception is rendered irrelevant. You will still have to face your ego needs. You will still continue to play out your personal dramas. This activity takes place on the stage of first attention. Offstage, spirit has its own devices. Your intention is like a blueprint handed to God, which he carries to completion in his own fashion. Sometimes he uses a miracle. Sometimes he just makes sure you don't miss the plane to New York. The fact that anything can happen is the beauty and surprise of the spiritual life. Strangely, people who feel extremely powerful and successful often set the worst intentions in motion as far as spiritual growth is concerned. Here are some typical intentions that have nothing to do with finding God. I want to win. I want to prove myself by taking risks. I want to have power over others. I want to make the rules. I want to be in control. I want to do it all my way. These intentions should sound very familiar since they are repeated ad nauseum in popular fiction, advertising, and the media. They all center on ego needs, and as long as your real intentions come from that level, your life will follow suit. Such is the fate of living in a mirror universe. One meets hundreds of people who mistake their own intentions because their egos have taken complete control. Some of the most powerful figures in the world are spiritually quite naive. If intention is left to the ego, great things can be accomplished, but these are minuscule compared to what can be achieved with infinite intelligence and organizing power at your disposal. God is on the side of abundance. It is a great misfortune that the spiritual life has earned a reputation for being poor, reclusive, and ascetic. God is also on the side of increased happiness. The shadow of the martyr has fallen over spirituality with dire results. In general, to be spiritual in these times means going it alone, far more than in the past. In a society with misguided conceptions of God and no tradition of masters, you are responsible for setting your own intentions. Here are the ground rules that have proved effective for me personally and which I feel will work for many people. 1. Know your intentions. Review the list of spiritual intentions and make sure that you understand how important they are. Your destiny is to move in the direction of your soul, but the fuel that makes destiny move is intention. Intend for yourself that the gap of separation gets closed just a little more each day. Don't let your false intentions remain masked. Root them out and work on the anger and fear that keep you attached to them. False intentions take the form of guilty desires. I want someone else to fail. I want to get even. I want to see bad people punished. I want to take away something not my own. False intentions can be elusive. You will notice their existence by the feeling tone connected with them, a feeling of fear, greed, rage, hopelessness, and weakness. Sense the feeling first, refuse to buy into it, and then remain aware until you find the intention lurking beneath. 2. Set your intentions high. Aim to be a saint and a miracle worker. Why not? The same laws of nature operate for everyone. If you know that the goal of inner growth is to acquire mastery, then ask for that mastery as soon as possible. Once you ask, don't strain to work wonders, but don't deny them to yourself either. The beginning of mastery is vision. See the miracles around you, and that will make it easier for greater miracles to grow. 3. See yourself in the light. The ego keeps its grip by making us feel needy and powerless. From this sense of lack grows the enormous hunger to acquire everything in sight. Money, power, sex, and pleasure are supposed to fill up the lack, but they never do. You can escape this whole package of illusion if you see yourself not in a shadow fighting to get to God, but as in the light from the first moment. The only difference between you and a saint is that your light is small and a saint's is great. This difference pales in comparison to the similarity. You are both of the light. The irony of near-death experiences is that when people come back to report how rapturously they felt bathed in blinding light, they overlook that the light was there all along. It is the self. 4. See everyone else in the light. The cheapest way to feel good about yourself is by feeling superior to others. From this dark seed grows every manner of judgment. Getting out of judgment is vital. And to plant that seed, you have to stop dividing others into categories of good and bad. Everyone lives in the same light. A simple formula may help here. When you're tempted to judge another person, no matter how obviously they deserve it, remind yourself that everyone is doing the best they can from their level of consciousness. 5. Reinforce your intentions every day. On the surface, the obstacles against spirit are enormous. Everyday life is a kind of swirling chaos, and the ego is entrenched in its demands. You cannot rely on one good intention to carry you through. It takes discipline to remind yourself, day in and day out, of your own spiritual purpose. For some people, it helps to write down their intentions. For others, periods of regular meditation and prayer are useful. It isn't good enough to repeat your intentions to yourself on the run. Find your center, look closely at yourself, and do not let go of your intention until it feels centered inside yourself. 6. Learn to forgive yourself. The ego has a way of co-opting spirit and pretending that everything is going well. Thus, we all fall into traps of selfishness and delusion when least expected. The chance remark that wounds someone else, the careless lie, the irresistible urge to cheat are universal. Forgive yourself for being where you are. To be honestly a creature of stage 2, driven by ambition and haunted by guilt, is more spiritual than pretending to be a saint. Apply to yourself the same dictum as to others. You are doing the best you can from your own level of consciousness. I like to remember one master's definition of the perfect disciple, one who is always stumbling but never falls. 7. Learn to let go. The paradox of being spiritual is that you are always wrong and always right at the same time. You are right to try to know God in every way you can, but you are wrong to think that things won't change tomorrow. Life is change. You must be prepared to let go of today's beliefs, thoughts, and actions, no matter how spiritual they make you feel. Every stage of inner growth is a good life. Each is nurtured by God. Only your second attention will know when it is time to move on. And when you know, don't hesitate to let go of the past. 8. Revere what is holy. Our society teaches us to be skeptical of the sacred. The usual attitude toward miracles is a bemused caution. Few people spend much time delving into the world's great wealth of scriptures. But every saint is your future, and every master is reaching over his shoulder to look at you, waiting for you to join him. The human representatives of God constitute an infinite treasure. Dipping into this treasure will help to open your heart. At just the moment when your soul wants to blossom, the words of a saint or sage may be the right fertilizer. 9. Allow God to take over. When all is said and done, either spirit has power or it doesn't. If there is only one reality, nothing in the material world stands outside God. This means that if you want something, spirit can provide it. Deciding what part you need to do and what part God will do is delicate. It also changes from stage to stage. You have to know yourself in this regard. No one else can tell you what to do. Most people are addicted to worry, control, overmanagement, and lack of faith. On a daily basis, resist the temptation to follow these tendencies. Don't listen to the voice that says you have to be in charge, that things aren't going to work out, that constant vigilance is the only way to get anything done. This voice is right because you listen to it too much. It won't be right if you let spirit try a new way. Be willing to experiment. Your intention is the most powerful tool at your disposal. Intend that everything will work out as it should. Then let go and see if clues come your way. Let opportunities and openings come your way. Your deepest intelligence knows much more about what is good for you than you do. See if its voice is speaking to you. Maybe the outcome you are trying to force so hard isn't ultimately as good for you as the outcome that naturally comes your way. If you could give 1% of your life over to God every day, you would be the most enlightened person in the world in 3 months. Keep that in mind and surrender something, anything, on a daily basis. 10. Embrace the unknown. You are not who you think you are. Since birth, your identity has depended on very limited experience. Over the years, you form likes and dislikes. You learn to accept certain limits. A hoard of objects acquired over time serves to prop up a fragile sense of fulfillment. None of this is the real you. Yet no one can instantly substitute the real for the false. It takes a process of discovery. Because it is painful to strip away so many layers of illusion, you have to let the unwinding of the soul take place according to its own rhythm and timing. Your overall attitude should be that the unknown is awaiting you, an unknown that has nothing to do with the I you already know. Some people reach the edge of illusion only at the moment of death, and then with a long look backward, one lifetime seems incredibly short and transient. Around 1890, a Blackfoot Indian chief was dying. His name was Isapwo Musika Crowfoot, and he whispered these words into the ear of a missionary father. What is life? It is the flash of a firefly in the night. It is the breath of a buffalo in the winter time. It is the little shadow that runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset. The part of us that we already know is the part of us that flickers out all too fast. Far better to seize this time and become timeless. When you feel a new impulse, an uplifting thought, an insight that you have never acted upon before, embrace the unknown. Cherish it as tenderly as a newborn baby. The unknown is the only thing that truly cares about the fate of your soul. Therefore, it would be good to revere it as much as you revere holiness. God lives in the unknown, and when you can embrace it fully, you will be home free.